From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
I turned the corner towards the San Jose into carnage. I mean, there were cars burning. In all, I counted 22 at the end of about half an hour there. Pieces of body parts in the road. I saw two, three people in all burning inside vehicles. There was a very big man lying on the pavement, whom I thought must have been a passerby. I realized a few hours ago, actually, it was almost certainly Rafiq Hariri.
As thousands jam the streets of Beirut for the funeral of the former Lebanese prime minister, we'll speak with Robert Fisk, who arrived at the scene minutes after the explosion, about Rafiq Hariri and the Iraqi elections. Then activists sued by McDonald's in Britain win a victory against the British government. They could change British libel law forever.
It was a complete nightmare fighting the case, but at the same time, it was a unique opportunity to examine the inner workings of a multinational company and expose their reality, get it out in the open, because normally that's kept under wraps.
And in this country, McDonald's settles a lawsuit over its use of trans fats, dangerously unhealthy oil. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Lebanon, over 150,000 mourners have filled the streets of Beirut to mark the funeral of Rafiq Hariri. The former prime minister was assassinated Monday, along with five bodyguards and eight others, in a massive car bombing. Tension between the U.S. and Syria is rising since the bombing, even though it has not been determined who carried out the attack. On Tuesday, the State Department recalled Margaret Scobie, its ambassador to Syria, to protest what it sees as Syria's link to the bombing. Before departing, Scobie delivered a message to the Syrian government to express, quote, deep concern as well as our profound outrage over the heinous act of terrorism. We'll have more on this story in a few minutes with Robert Fisk. In news from Iraq, the Shiite Muslim coalition that won Iraq's election has chosen Ibrahim Jafari as the prime ministerial candidate. He's currently serving as the country's interim vice president, heads the Dawah Party, a leading Shiite political party. Jafari lived in exile for most of the last 25 years, including 10 in Iran. In previous interviews, he said Islam should be the official religion of Iraq and that Islam should serve as one of the main sources for Iraqi law. Jafari has also spoken increasing ties with Iran. He said, quote, I personally look at Iran as part of the geographical entourage of Iraq and a friendly state which stood by Iraq in time of crisis. In other news from Iraq, the Associated Press has obtained a videotape of kidnapped Italian journalist Giuliana Segrena pleading for her life. On the tape, Segrena is seen sobbing and clasping her hands. She says, quote, you must end the occupation. It's the only way we can get out of this situation. Here in the United States, a federal appeals court ruled Tuesday that the government can send two prominent reporters to prison if they refuse to disclose their confidential sources. The ruling comes in a case centered on the outing of CIA operative Valerie Plame. A grand jury has been attempting to force Judith Miller of The New York Times and Matthew Cooper of Time magazine to disclose who they privately talked to while researching the story. Reporters Without Borders harshly criticized the court ruling, said in a statement, quote, the role of the press in providing checks and balances is under fire this time, and the U.S. courts must understand that if the confidentiality of journalist sources is not guaranteed, no one will go to them with sensitive information. The organization went on to say, quote, by protecting the identity of their sources, journalists are safeguarding society's right to monitor public affairs. Meanwhile, in other journalism news, a federal judge has ruled the governor of Maryland can legally prohibit state employees from speaking with certain reporters from the Baltimore Sun. The judge ruled, quote, the right to publish news is expansive. However, the right does not carry with it the unrestrained right to gather information. Baltimore Sun editor Tim Franklin described the ruling as scary. Franklin said, quote, essentially what the court is saying is that it's okay for a politician to create an enemies list. In news from Capitol Hill, the Senate voted 98-0 Tuesday to approve Michael Chertoff as the new head of the Department of Homeland Security. Meanwhile, the American Civil Liberties Union has called on newly sworn-in Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez to appoint a special counsel to investigate the torture of detainees in Iraq and at Guantanamo Bay. The ACLU claimed an independent counsel is needed because of Gonzalez, quote, an avoidable conflict of interest in fully investigating and prosecuting wrongdoing by civilians in this matter. An Australian microbiologist involved in the U.S. search for weapons of mass destruction in Iraq has come forward to publicly accuse the CIA of censoring his reporting so that it suggested the weapons existed. Rod Barton also accused the head of Britain's Joint Intelligence Committee of wanting to make the report sexier. The head of the UN Nuclear Watchdog Agency has cast new doubts on the Bush administration's claim that Iran is building nuclear weapons. Mohammed El-Bardai of the International Atomic Energy Agency said there have been no discoveries in the last 6 months to substantiate claims that Iran is secretly working toward building a nuclear bomb. El-Bardai also praised France, Britain, and Germany for negotiating with Iran that led to the suspicion of its nuclear activities. In military news, for the second time in 2 months, a major test of the proposed national missile defense system has failed. In Brazil, thousands gathered Tuesday for the funeral of Dorothy Stang, the American nun and environmentalist who was murdered Saturday. She'd struggled for decades to protect the Amazon rainforest and to support the landless movement in Brazil. Many have accused logging interests in being behind the killing. Development, logging, and farming have destroyed as much as 20% of the Amazon's 1.6 million square miles. A fellow nun from Brazil said, quote, they wanted to shut her up because she was messing up their plans. Dorothy Stang is seen as the most prominent activist to be murdered in the Amazon since Chico Mendes in 1988. This news from Washington, and one of its first official acts, the newly reconfigured U.S. Commission on Civil Rights, has removed 20 recent public reports from its website. Many of the reports were critical of the Bush administration. One of the purged reports was entitled Redefining Rights in America, the Civil Rights Record of George W. Bush Administration. In December, Bush replaced the top two officials on the commission, including longtime chair Mary Frances Berry. Bush then named a longtime critic of affirmative action named Gerald Reynolds to head the commission. In 1997, Reynolds criticized affirmative action as a, quote, corrupt system of preferences, set-asides, and quotas. Meanwhile, a federal health agency is coming under criticism after it forced the organizers of an upcoming federally funded conference on suicide prevention to remove from the program the words gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender. The Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration made the request after it learned that an upcoming conference in Portland, Oregon, was to include talk entitled Suicide Prevention Among Gay, Lesbian, Bisexual, Transgender Individuals. Under pressure, the organizers were forced to change the name of the talk to, quote, Suicide Prevention in Vulnerable Populations. Studies have found that the suicide risk among people in these groups is 2 to 3 times higher than the average risk. Meanwhile, the daughter of former Republican presidential candidate Alan Keyes has come out as a gay activist. In her first public statement, Maya Marcel Keyes recalled that when her parents learned she was a lesbian, they threw her out of the house, stopped speaking to her, and refused to pay for her college education. Last summer, Alan Keyes called homosexuality, quote, selfish hedonism. He also described Vice President Dick Cheney's daughter, Mary, as a sinner for being a lesbian. In 2000, when Keyes was running for president, his daughter convinced him to jump in a mosh pit organized by filmmaker Michael Moore in return for Moore's endorsement for Keyes for president. Cheney's other daughter, Elizabeth, is also in the news. On Tuesday, Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice named Elizabeth Cheney to become the new Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for the Near East. She'll become the second highest-ranking U.S. diplomat for the Middle East. And finally, two British newspapers have agreed to pay singer Cat Stevens a substantial sum to settle a libel suit. Last year, U.S. immigration officials blocked the singer from entering the country. After the incident, the Sunday Times and the Sun ran articles suggesting he had ties to terrorists. The singer, who's now known as Yusuf Islam, said, quote, it seems to me the easiest thing in the world these days to make scurrilous accusations against Muslims. The harm done is often difficult to repair. ¶¶
Now I've been happy lately, thinking about the good things to come. And I believe it could be something good has begun. Oh, I've been smiling lately, dreaming about the world at one. And I believe it could be someday it's going to come. 'Cause out on the edge of darkness, there rides a peace train. Oh, peace train, take this country, come take me home again. Now I've been smiling lately, thinking about the good things to come. And I believe it could be something good has begun. Oh, peace train sounding louder.
Ride on the peace train.
Peace Train, Cat Stevens, now known as Yusuf Islam. Here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Former Lebanese Prime Minister Rafik Hariri was buried today in chaotic scenes at a mosque in Beirut. He was killed along with 14 others in a massive bomb blast Monday. Over 150,000 mourners marched in a funeral procession to the Mohammed Amin Mosque in one of Lebanon's biggest and most diverse gatherings for decades. Reuters reports the funeral turned into an outpouring of public wrath against Syria, which is blamed by opposition leaders for the killing. Some 15,000 Syrian troops are stationed in Lebanon. Hariri's family turned down government offers of a state funeral. They made clear government officials such as Syrian-backed President Emil Lahoud, along with his prime minister and interior minister, were not welcome to attend the funeral. Hariri resigned as prime minister last October after falling out with Syria over its role in extending the presidential term of Lahoud. Meanwhile, the U.S. has recalled its ambassador to Syria to protest the bombing. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice told reporters she's not blaming the attack on Syria, but said its presence in Lebanon is destabilizing. She said the U.S. is discussing response to the bombing with the U.N. and considering further diplomatic sanctions against Syria over a range of U.S. complaints. Meanwhile, French President Jacques Chirac will travel to Beirut Wednesday to attend the funeral. Several other foreign dignitaries are also expected, including U.S. Assistant Secretary of State William Burns, Arab League General Secretary Amr Moussa, and EU Foreign Policy Chief Javier Solana. Yesterday, we reached Robert Fisk, journalist in Lebanon, chief Middle East correspondent for the London Independent, who's lived in Beirut for many years. He's the author of Pity the Nation, The Abduction of Lebanon. He arrived at the scene from his home just moments after the explosion on Monday and described what he saw.
Well, I was sitting, actually working at the desk where I'm sitting at the moment talking to you. And I had a call from my colleague in Baghdad, Patrick Coburn, and we'd been talking for about a minute. There was an extraordinary explosion. All the shutters of my house blew open. The windows at the back broke. And I looked out the window, and I actually saw the blast wave, a kind of white wave going down the corniche, the seafront in front of my house. Very odd for my colleague in Baghdad to hear a bomb in Beirut. And the first thing I did was run out into the street and look up into the sky, because I thought that since the Israelis often overfly Beirut and create pretty noisy sonic booms, this may have been them. And then I looked down the corniche, and very close to me, 400 or 500 meters, very close to the Saint George Hotel, which is still in ruins from the war but under reconstruction, was a great swath, if you like to use your favorite American phrases, of brown and black smoke. And what happened was that I ran down the road towards the scene. It was obviously a car bomb. I mean, I've been 28 years here. I know the sound of a car bomb. And I arrived at the bottom of the road. Many people were running in the other direction, some of them with blood on their clothes and obviously in a state of considerable distress. And I turned the corner towards the Saint-Georges into carnage. I mean, there were cars burning. In all, I counted 22 at the end of about half an hour there. Pieces of body parts in the road. I saw 2-3 people in all burning inside vehicles. there was a very big man lying on the pavement whom I thought must have been a passerby. I realized a few hours ago, actually, it was almost certainly Rafiq Hariri. But someone came and put a checkered blanket over him, and he was taken away. I can't confirm it was, but having seen the photographs later of the blanket, it probably was. It was very difficult to assess what was happening because there was lots of brown smoke. There was the smell of explosives and the smell of bodies burning, meat. At one point, several cars, petrol tanks, exploded and sprayed fire over the road. So I was running between the vehicles trying to avoid the flames. At one point, I found a car in which I thought it was a woman, but I'm told now it was a man, was burning alive. Well, they were dead, but they had been burned alive. And the top of their skull was missing. And just behind the vehicle was a huge hole in the ground, a crater. I estimated at the time about 15, 20 feet. Looking back, it was about 30 feet. And much later, when the police arrived, I actually climbed into it with the Lebanese detectives, and we were looking at pieces of the car bomb, which was only about an inch long. You know, I mean, this was a huge explosion, 350 kilos. It must have been at least. This wasn't a suicide bomb. You couldn't drive this car. But it was planted beside the empty, derelict Saint-Georges Hotel, a bomb of such power that it blasted one of Hariri's cars three floors up the annex, again empty, of the Saint-Georges Hotel. This is the old hotel from the 50s and 60s in which, you know, Richard Burton and Elizabeth Taylor used to stay. And I had no idea, because the cars were so smashed, that it was Hariri's convoy, you know, his armored convoy of vehicles, which even has anti, you know, booby trap bomb electronic equipment on the roof. The cars were on fire. They were exploding. I was trying to, you know, avoid getting killed in the aftermath of the bombing. And then I saw a man I recognized who was wounded. And I knew he was one, or he used to be one, of Rafiq Hariri's bodyguards. And I said to him, "Are you okay?" And he said, ya Allah, the big man has gone." And I sort of took it in. Again, you have to understand, I was trying to make sure I didn't get killed by exploding cars, but I sort of took it in that Hariri must have been there. But at the same time, if he's gone, it means he'd managed to get away, he was okay, you know, he'd managed to escape from this terrible inferno. I mean, at one point, I found a woman's hand on the road. It was a woman's glove with a hand inside it. My impression was that if it was Hariri, he was okay. But then I met another colleague of mine much later who arrived from somewhere else in the city. Obviously, he wasn't as close as I was to the bombing, who said there's a rumor they've got Rafiq Hariri, the former Prime Minister of Lebanon, and that he's dead. And from that moment, I went back to my apartment here where I'm sitting now. And I told my landlord downstairs, who's a Druze Lebanese, I said, "There's a rumor that it's Hariri that killed him." And he said, "Yeah, Allah, I can't believe this. I can't believe this." I said, "I think you might have to." And much later, I went back down the road to look at the vehicles and realized that they were armored Mercedes. They were obviously the convoy. And it took at least 2 hours before the government, in the shape, ironically, of the Minister of Tourism, of all people, confirmed that Hariri was dead. I find it very hard to believe because I knew Hariri pretty well. You know, I don't think journalists should say they're friends of prime ministers and so on, but he was a person I knew pretty well. I mean, I had lunch with him, dinner with him, I had coffee with him, I'd been to see him sometimes. His secretary would ring me up and say, "Do you want to drop by the office and tell me what's going on in Iraq. You know, I wouldn't tell him any more than he learned from my articles if he read them. But he wanted to hear what was happening from someone other than government officials. And it was very hard when I realized in this inferno of fire and body parts to think that this extremely, immensely wealthy, powerful man, you know, who had met Bush, Clinton, was listened to by Saudi kings and emirs, a man who was a very close personal friend of Jacques Chirac, could have suddenly been extinguished in this inferno of smoke and fire. There you go. That's Lebanese politics. I guess it's Middle East life too.
Now, Robert Fisk, he traveled in a convoy of well-armed Mercedes because he knew this was a possibility. Who did he fear?
Oh, he feared everyone. He feared the Israelis. He feared the Syrians. He feared the Americans. He probably feared the Russians. When you're a billionaire tycoon like Rafik Hariri was, you know, you take these precautions. He did once drive me down the corniche outside my house here, actually, in a Range Rover, with just one car behind him and no protection at all. But those were earlier days, not in these current fraught and tense times. But he was a man who, you see, he was basically a businessman. He made his billions, millions in Saudi Arabia. He had a Saudi passport as well. And he was also, in his way, a philanthropist. He liked being loved, which is both nice and dangerous for various reasons. He would give, you know, millions to set up a new hospital in southern Lebanon. He spent millions and millions sending Lebanese students to British universities. My own driver, Abed here, his son Issam, was sent to Essex University in England on a scholarship, which was paid for by Hariri. He was biased towards the Sunni Muslim community. He was a Sunni, otherwise he couldn't have been the prime minister, because this is a sectarian system of society here. The president has to be a Christian Maronite, the prime minister a Sunni Muslim, the speaker of parliament a Shia Muslim, and so on and so forth, as I'm sure you know. But he was, I mean, he had clean hands up to a point. He was a very ruthless businessman, but he never had a militia. He didn't have murders on his hands. I mean, the speaker of parliament here, Nabi Berri, the Shiite Amal leader, still controls the militia. You know, the president controls a 70,000-strong army. Suleiman Frangieh's relatives controlled a very brutal militia in northern Lebanon in the war, which ended in 1990. Of course, 15 years, cost 150,000 lives. But Hariri didn't have a militia. He had clean hands. And there was an odd way in which if you got to know him, I mean, you could realize how ruthless he could be in business and how you wouldn't want to oppose him in business. I once wrote an article saying that Hariri was like the cat that ate the family canary and then smiled and commented to the family, rather than saying he didn't do it, saying it really tasted rather good. And I assumed that Hariri would loathe this. So he was probably intended to loathe it by me. And about a week or two later, I found out he'd been faxing this article to not only his friends but his political enemies. He thought this was pretty accurate, which it was, actually. And he was a man who didn't ever say sorry.
Robert Fisk of the Independent newspaper, he was sitting at home when the explosion took place in Beirut, ran down the street, and saw the carnage. We'll be back in a minute.
Thank you.
Marcel Khalife, back to Beirut here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, broadcasting on over 300 stations around the country, on Pacifica radio stations, on public access TV stations, on PBS stations, and on NPR stations. We're also broadcasting on both satellite TV networks, on Dish Network's channel 9415 Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, as well as on DirecTV, channel 375 Link TV. We also video and audio stream at democracynow.org, where you can get the full interview with Robert Fisk. Also, we are closed captioned for people who are deaf and hard of hearing. I'm Amy Goodman. As we continue with Robert Fisk, who we reached late yesterday, Robert Fisk of the Independent newspaper, voted best foreign correspondent by editors and reporters in Britain year after year. He was startled by the explosion in Beirut, ran out of his home, and saw the carnage. He talked about the Syrian presence in Lebanon.
Syria, you see, has a strategic reason for being here. In 1982, the Israelis invaded Lebanon and got up to beyond Jenin. And had they struck east with their tanks, they could have cut Syria in half. And Syria wants to make sure there are going to be no more pro-Israeli governments or Israeli-sponsored governments in Beirut who might allow such a devastating event to take place in Syria. So there's a kind of long-term strategic reason why the Syrians are here. They're not here because they, you know, want to throw snowballs on the mountain of Sinin, or they like Iraq, or they're keen on Lebanese society. They're here for strategic military reasons.
Robert Fisk, the President Bush recalling the U.S. ambassador in Syria following the killing of the former Lebanese prime minister and condemning the foreign occupation of Lebanon?
Well, Bush is lining up Syria in his sights. At this moment of all moments, the United States probably needs an ambassador in Syria. It's still got the embassy open. He hasn't broken off diplomatic relations. It's a warning to Syria, because obviously America is lining up Syria as the culprit, the person which killed Hariri. And many Lebanese would believe that. As I've said many times since this crime occurred, that might be a bit simplistic. I'm not saying the Syrians were not involved. The Syrians know everything that goes on in Lebanon. Therefore, did they not know that this huge bombing was going to take place? Important question. But my experience of Lebanon is that when the leading figures like President Mawawad back in the 80s was assassinated, it's not that someone stands up like, you know, the British king, the English king, and says, who will rid me of this troublesome priest? Thomas Becket in that case. It's that comes an awareness that various groups of people, be they the Syrians, be they political opponents of Hariri, be they economic opponents of Hariri, etc., all feel angry. And when a certain temperature is reached, someone, some dark person, will step forward from the shadows and say to all of them, well, gentlemen, can I be of assistance? In other words, there's a kind of unwritten alliance of opponents and enemies of a person which needs to exist before events like yesterday take place in Lebanon. The idea that in some Hollywood way, you know, a dictator or an autocrat says, kill this man. This may be CNN or ABC's version of events, but it's not real. The real event is actually much more dramatic and rather more chilling, but I think Hariri had a lot of enemies as well as a lot of friends. Enemies in the business world. He was a huge property owner, property buyer. He was always buying huge areas of Beirut. I remember once saying to him, is it true you've just bought Rauche up the hill from my home? He said, I think so, I can't remember. quite a few businessmen were bitterly, bitterly hostile towards him because they believed that their own property and wealth had been diminished to the point of zero by the extraordinary tornado of Hariri's business acumen. Now, these are Lebanese, not Syrian. But you can see how, in a small country where you have a very big man, not just physically, but politically and particularly financially, you can have various nodules, if you like to use an old sort of academic cliche, various groups, groupuscule of people who don't like him. And then add to that a political dislike within Lebanon, or add to that tensions in a foreign country, let's say Syria. And you can see that you reach a point where the oven gets white hot, at which point there's a detonation. Now, maybe that's what happened yesterday.
Robert Fisk, I wanted to switch gears to Iraq, or maybe it's not completely switching gears.
I want to write a story, actually. I'm going to have to interrupt you. I'm going to have to break off.
Could I just get a quick response, just a very quick response on the election results?
A swifty, Amy. Go ahead.
A quick response on the election results and the reports out of AP that the choice for the race for prime minister has narrowed to interim Vice President Ibrahim al-Jafari and Ahmed Chalabi, the former Pentagon favorite.
Yeah, well, look, the real question is, what is the role in all this of the U.S. Embassy in Baghdad, the largest U.S. embassy in the world, and Ambassador Negroponte, whose reputation for supporting human rights and so on is obviously well known to your listeners. The Shiites did not vote for Ahmed Chalabi. They did not for coalitions. They voted for the establishment of Shiite power with, of course, Sunnis and Kurds in Iraq. The Kurds did not vote for Iraq. They voted for Kurdistan. If you went to Kurdistan during the election, there wasn't a single Iraqi flag flying. I actually flew into Erbil not long ago and discovered that the airport had been renamed, I think it was Hawa, I can't remember now, which is a Kurdish for Erbil. And that although I could read everything, because it was an Arabic script, I couldn't understand it. There simply wasn't any more Arabic language there. And the Sunnis, as we know, either intimidated or through their own boycott, didn't vote. Very divisive election, but it did prove that the Shiites should be the power. If they're not going to get power, the Shiites, whom President Bush claimed were, you know, a great danger themselves, going to vote for democracy, but who in fact told us they were going to vote because they wanted an end to the American occupation and they wanted their own majority status at 60% of the population represented in parliament and the government, are going to be very, very angry indeed. But, you know, it's wheels within wheels. If the Americans construct a powerless coalition with one of their own satraps involved, and they do not permit, in effect, the Shiites, who are 60% of the population, to have a controlling interest in administration, especially when the Shiites have shown such forbearance towards the Sunnis and the Kurds, then the worst dreams, the worst nightmares, if you like, of the Americans, which is that the Shiites will join the insurgency, and they held the elections to try and stop them joining the insurgency, will become reality.
Robert Fisk, speaking from Beirut, Lebanon, the reporter for The Independent of London, was there minutes after the explosion that killed a former prime minister of Lebanon, who was buried today. If you'd like to hear the entire interview with Robert Fisk, you can go to our website at democracynow.org. Well, we turn now to Britain. Two activists sued by McDonald's in Britain won their case against the British government, and a case that could change British libel law forever. The European Court of Human Rights said the British legal system breached the right to a fair trial and freedom of expression. Activists David Morris and Helen Steele were sued by McDonald's in 1990 for handing out leaflets called "What's Wrong with McDonald's," accusing the company of paying low wages, cruelty to animals used in its products, destruction of the rainforest, and dozens of other malpractices. McDonald's won and was awarded £40,000 in libel damages, but the so-called McLibel II refused to pay at the end of the trial. Well, yesterday they won their claim that the libel trial was unfair in the longest civil and criminal action in English legal history. David Morris spoke outside a McDonald's in Britain moments after the ruling.
Right, well, basically it's a victory. Not only did we score some amazing victories in the court in the UK because the judge ruled that McDonald's exploit children with their advertising, that they deceptively promote their food as nutritious, that
they pay low wages.
Pay low wages, such as to lower wages in the catering industry, and they're culpably responsible for cruelty to animals. So, on top of that, we won further at the Court of Appeal, and this was our third major court hearing, and we won hands down both our points that the libel laws of this country are oppressive and they're unfair.
That was former postman David Morris. The other person in the case was Helen Steele. She also spoke after the ruling.
Nightmare fighting the case, but at the same time, it was a unique opportunity to examine the inner workings of a multinational company and expose their reality, get it out in the open, because normally that's kept under wraps.
That was Helen Steele, David Morris, as they join us on the phone now from Britain. David Morris, can you talk about this case, which has two aspects? First, what you said about McDonald's and their suit against you, and then finally, the significance of this court case, which goes to British libel law. You might change British libel law forever.
Well, it's a very long case to kind of sum up, really. 15 years of legal argument and legal action. But basically, McDonald's brought the case to try and silence public criticisms that were being made, well, specifically by London Greenpeace, but they'd also sued dozens of other organisations before they sued us. Everybody had backed down because the laws are well known to be stacked in favour of the rich and powerful in the UK. So a climate of fear had been created where no one was prepared to speak out about the company. But we decided that we had to fight the case because on principle to defend freedom of speech. And so it went on from there. Really, we didn't know what we were doing at the beginning, but by the time we got to trial, you know, we were getting more and more experience. We were getting victories. We were getting documents. The company was forced to disclose documents that would otherwise remain hidden. And so on and so forth. And really, it became the longest trial in English history. And then we had some devastating verdicts against McDonald's, as you heard, at the end of that case. But amazingly, no legal sanctions were ordered against McDonald's for what they had lost. And yet we were expected to pay the company, this huge corporation, £40,000. And that's what forced us really to go to the European Court to say that the laws are ridiculous in the UK.
Helen Steele, what was your reaction to the ruling?
Well, obviously, you know, we're very pleased that the European Court in Strasbourg has finally recognised what we've been saying for the last 15 years, which is that UK libel laws are oppressive and unfair and act as a barrier to freedom of speech for ordinary people. But at the same time, we also think, you know, it should be recognised just how much we won despite all those odds stacked against us, you know. So, it's like one victory on top of another, really. It's great. So,
Helen, there were actually five of you that McDonald's sued, but only two of you remained in this. Why? And what happened to the other three?
Well, when we got, when McDonald's served the writs on us, we were actually told that because there's no legal aid for libel and because the UK libel laws are so complicated and oppressive, that we didn't really stand a chance of being able to work our way through all the complex procedures and so on. And under those circumstances, the other three people reluctantly felt that they had that they were forced into apologising. They've actually retracted that apology and said that basically it was made under duress. But when it came to my turn to sort of say, well, okay, you know, we're on a hiding to nothing, it just really stuck in my throat to apologise to McDonald's. You know, I felt like, well, actually, it's McDonald's who should be apologising to society for the damage that they do to society and to the environment. And I just decided that really, come what may, I was going to fight it just because I thought it was bad to give in to bullying and intimidation.
We're talking to Helen Steele and David Morris. We're going to break, and then when we come back, we'll talk about the actual charges they made against McDonald's and their pamphlets that they gave to people outside of McDonald's. And then we're going to look at a case in the United States where McDonald's has just settled a major lawsuit that was brought by a website called bantransfats.org, bantransfat.com, about a very dangerous oil that is used in their food that most people thought they were no longer using. This is Democracy Now! Our guests are Helen Steele and David Morris. We'll be back with them in a minute.
Al cementerio se va la vaca de mala leche. Al cementerio se va, inocente condena. Al cementerio se va la vaca de mala leche. Al cementerio se va, ni Dios le va a perdonar. Bailemos todo el vaca loca, ese ritmo terminal. Bailemos todo el vaca loca, bailemos todo hasta el final. Pa'l cementerio se va la vaca de mala leche. Pa'l cementerio se va.
Mano Chao, La Vaca Loca, The Crazy Cow, here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we look at McDonald's in Britain and the United States, a major lawsuit against activists, a former postman, a former farmer in Britain, and then we'll look at the case of the use of trans fats by McDonald's in the United States, and we'll be speaking with people who sued them here. We're going to go back to our guests in Britain right now. Again, won a major legal victory. Can you talk about what was in the pamphlet you gave out to people who were going to McDonald's?
Well, basically, the leaflet criticizes McDonald's for promoting unhealthy food, exploiting their workers through low pay, and through the fact that they're hostile to trade unions. The damage to the environment through masses of unnecessary packaging, cruelty to the animals reared for the meat products, and it criticised their massive advertising budget and the targeting of children through the advertising. I mean, they're all basically common sense criticisms that are actually made quite widely now, and you know, London Greenpeace wasn't actually the first to make those criticisms in any event. It just kind of brought all the different criticisms together to take a kind of overall look at the effect of multinational corporations on society.
I think also it's fair to say that it wasn't just McDonald's that was under the spotlight. It was basically McDonald's is a symbol of what the whole fast food industry and indeed all multinationals together, whole economic system, is doing in terms of its domination over our lives and our environment.
And so then explain exactly what happened. You're giving out these pamphlets. How many days did you do it? And then what happened? How did McDonald's approach you when they sued you?
Well, London Greenpeace had started a campaign against McDonald's and the whole fast food industry, and the leaflets that were being given out were fantastically well received by the public, because McDonald's spend $2 billion every year through their advertising, effectively forcing their views on the public, and people were crying out for an alternative point of view. So the group was quite enthusiastic about the way things were being received, but of course McDonald's had a different idea about it, and the first contact that members of the group had with McDonald's were the writs, which were served saying there's going to be a court case.
And so at the point where you lost the case, on what grounds, or you won on some points, lost on others, what grounds did you win on and then lose on?
Well, it was a mixed verdict. Remarkably, the judge managed to find that they weren't responsible for litter or environmental damage, but he actually found that they were that their food had pretended to a positive nutritional benefit, their advertising had pretended to a positive nutritional benefit, which their food didn't match, that they exploit children with their advertising strategy, that they were responsible for animal cruelty, that they paid low wages, helping to depress wages in the catering trade. And then we also won further points on appeal about that if you ate enough of McDonald's food, your diet might well become high in fat with a very real risk of heart disease, and also further points about employment conditions.
So pretty much their core business practices were found to be, you know, strongly lacking. These were devastating, probably the worst judgments ever made against a multinational corporation. We didn't win on all points. We didn't win on concerns over food safety issues. We didn't win over the McDonald's direct involvement in destruction of rainforests, even though the beef industry as a whole has been very strongly responsible for some of the devastation of Amazonian forests. So, you know, there was our continuing arguments, and we went to appeal, and then, you know, we took it to the European Court.
And so now what happens? Do you get paid back for your, 15 years of legal struggle?
Well, really, it's not about money, is it? It's about matters of principle. We really felt actually we'd already won, we'd beaten McDonald's in the actual trial, but most importantly, not just inside the courtroom, but outside the courtroom, leaflets are now being given out in millions all over the world criticising the company. But more important than that, there's a vibrant public debate, an increasing concern to challenge the promotion of unhealthy food, to look at what multinationals are doing to our lives. There's a whole anti-capitalist movement that's grown up in the last 10 years, which I think the McLeibel campaign helped to stimulate. And I think people are looking for a real alternative. And obviously, there's still a lot of work to do. Multinationals and governments still dominate our lives for their own interests. And we're part of a number of different groups and campaigns that are trying to change things for the better, mostly in the area where we live, which is in North London.
Well, I want to thank you both for being with us, David Morris and Helen Steele, who were sued by McDonald's. And report McDonald's has said, the McDonald's UK office, that the case related to a claim made against the British government. It was therefore inappropriate for the company to comment on this case or its outcome. The company said it's impossible to note the allegations related to practices in the 80s. The world has moved on since then, and so has McDonald's. David Morris, I'll give you the final word.
I don't think it's moved on at all. I think that it's more of the same, that nothing's changed. I don't think that multinational corporations, in fact, can change because they're only interested in one thing, which is making profits for their shareholders. And really, if things are going to change, it will be, could be because people, wherever they live, wherever they work, you know, get organized and stand up for their rights and speak out and really try and create a different kind of society based on people's needs rather than, you know, the power of multinationals and governments.
David Morris, Helen Steele, thanks for joining us from Britain. As we move to this country, McDonald's has settled a lawsuit over its use of trans fats, a dangerously unhealthy oil. The hamburger chain has to pay $8.5 million for advertising claims that it cut trans fat from its French fries. The company announced the switch to healthier oil in September of 2002. But 5 months later, they said there was a delay. The suit was filed by the consumer advocacy group BanTransFat.com. It accused McDonald's of failing to inform customers that the heart-clogging oil was still being used. Of the $8.5 million payment, $7 million goes to the American Heart Association to educate the public about trans fat in foods. As part of the settlement, McDonald's required to spend $1.5 million publicizing that it didn't follow through on its 2002 pledge. We're joined now by Kathy Fetke, plaintiff in the $8 million lawsuit with McDonald's, as well as Stephen Joseph. He's the founder and president of BanTransFats.com and the attorney for the plaintiff in its representative action against McDonald's for injunctive relief. He's also the attorney in another case. We welcome you both to the show. Thank you very much for joining us. Catherine Fetke, why did you bring this lawsuit?
Well, in 2002, I was very thrilled to hear the news that McDonald's was reducing the amount of trans fats in their oil, and I saw the news story everywhere. I work in the news, so not only did I hear it in the newsroom, but I heard it, it was in every newspaper and television program. So I was very happy, and I'm somebody who cares a lot about my health, and I have heart disease and breast cancer in my family, so I've been told to avoid trans fats, as should most people. So I was very, very surprised to find out that they had never changed the oil. That's why we did the lawsuit, mm-hmm. because it was misrepresentation.
How did McDonald's originally respond?
Steve, well, I guess, Amy, you'd want to ask me about that.
Okay.
Because the response was to me. Amy, I can't get too much into the facts and details of the lawsuit. Essentially, the problem was that McDonald's achieved huge national and international publicity with its September 2002 announcement, and I mean huge, record-breaking publicity, telling the world that the trans fat levels in its products, including especially its French fries, was being reduced. In the case of French fries, being reduced by 48%. That's a heck of a reduction for what is a product with a very high trans fat content. Vast majority of people thought that they had followed through and had changed the oil, but in fact they never did. McDonald's issued a press release in February of 2003 saying there was a delay. The press release was issued on a Friday night. It received very minimal publicity, and so people were continuing to rely on the earlier press release and all of the publicity, thinking that the oil had been changed, but it hadn't. So that was the reason for suing McDonald's.
Stephen, I want to add that I did some research. I wanted to find out what was in McDonald's foods, and it was hard to find the nutritional content.
At that time, there was no information on the website regarding trans fats.
Well, can you explain what trans fats are?
There are four kinds of fat, saturated fat, trans fat, polyunsaturated fat, and monounsaturated fat. Trans fat comes from two sources. It comes from natural sources. It's found in beef and dairy products and some other natural sources. But mostly we get trans fat from the partial hydrogenation of vegetable oils. And that kind of trans fat is dangerous to our health. That kind of trans fat, the artificial trans fat, not only increases LDL cholesterol, which is the bad type of cholesterol, but it also reduces HDL cholesterol, which is the good type of cholesterol that we must have. That's the kind of cholesterol that helps to keep our arteries clear. So that's why it's been found to have an extremely negative effect on our health. According to the Harvard School of Public Health, the presence of trans fat in our food supply is causing between 30,000 and 100,000 premature heart attack deaths per year in this country alone. That's up to 274 deaths per day. Now, that is just the deaths. That's not counting the heart attacks from which people don't die. That is a terrible thing, and that's something that should be removed from our food supply. And in fact, the Bush administration last month, in announcing the dietary guidelines, included a statement in there that the food industry has an important role in removing this substance from our food.
And looking at a New York Times piece that says, according to one survey on trans fat issued by the FDA in 1999, partially hydrogenated oil was in 95% of cookies, 100% of crackers, 80% of frozen breakfast foods on supermarket shelves. Margarine, very high in trans fat, one of the first foods to change. So if you go into McDonald's, how do you know what's being used? And was trans fat used to replace beef tallow because of the protests against vegetarians and Hindus who didn't realize that beef tallow was used in the oil cooking the French fries?
Well, you're kind of confusing the issues there. Up until about 15 years ago, McDonald's used animal vegetable fats for its frying. And then there were objections to that, and not only from vegetarians and Jewish people, but generally, you know, there was a feeling that animal vegetable oils were too high in saturated fat. So McDonald's switched to partially hydrogenated oil. Now, at that time, it was not as well known as it is now that trans fats were problematic for health. It was only as time went on that this really came to light. So McDonald's wasn't, you know, was acting properly and was acting really in what it thought was, you know, the public interest when it switched to the partially hydrogenated oil in the early 90s. But in fact, unfortunately, as it turned out, that oil was worse than what it was replacing. And then they were faced with the problem of having to replace it again. McDonald's did try very hard to change the oil. We're not critical of them at all in that regard. In fact, but were highly complimentary because they did attempt to make the change. They ran into difficulties, and things just didn't work out. You know, sometimes, you know, with the best of intentions, things don't necessarily work out, and they did have the best of intentions. The problem was, from our point of view, that they didn't tell the world that the plan hadn't worked out.
But they got a lot of attention when they announced they weren't going to use it. We asked McDonald's to join us. They didn't, but sent us their statement. It talks about the settlement, about giving $7 million to the American Heart Association, then says McDonald's has been successful in reducing TFA levels, trans fat, in our Chicken McNuggets, Crispy Chicken Sandwich, and McChicken Sandwich. Meanwhile, TFA information is available to McDonald's customers in our restaurants and on our McDonald's websites. It is important to note McDonald's continues to work hard on our initiative to reduce TFAs in our cooking oil. Why is it so hard to change?
Well, actually, Amy, unfortunately, I can't really talk about that because I'm under a protective order. So, you know, I'm restricted in what I can say. I learned, you know, the relevant facts through discovery in the court case, and it's considered to be proprietary business information. So I'm really restricted in what I can say about that. So unfortunately, you know, you'll have to ask another question.
Are you planning, bantransfats.com, to sue other companies that use these partially hydrogenated oils, since they're used in 100% of, well, you know, whatever, cookies and other things?
I'm not quite sure what we're going to do in the future. We're still dealing with, you know, the McDonald's case. There's a final hearing in August to resolve some of the loose ends, but the court did preliminarily approve the settlement last week, so things are moving to a conclusion, and we'll think about what we're going to do in the future, you know, in the coming months.
Well, Stephen Joseph and Kathy Fetke, I want to thank you very much for being with us. This is Democracy Now! As we wrap up, if you'd like to get a copy of today's broadcast, you can call 1-800-881-2359. That's 1-800-881-2359. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdelkaddous, John Hamilton, Anna Nagara, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Richin, and Jeremy Scahill. Mike DeFilippo and Ryan Abernathy are engineers. Special thanks to Dennis Moynihan and Angela Alston. Our website is democracynow.org. This weekend, Friday night, I'll be in Dallas, and then in Austin on Saturday. I'm Amy Goodman. Thank you very much for joining us.